Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello again, everybody. Happy Friday. New York Times correspondent Jody Cantor is here. If you've been reading anything about class and gender in the New York Times this week, Jody probably wrote it. She had that big front page article about the massive gender equality experiment with the Harvard Business School class of 13, a follow-up on the class divide there, and then yesterday's article about lingering questions of gender and sexuality in Christine Quinn's failed mayoral campaign. Jody Cantor joins us now. Hi, Jody. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you for having me back, Brian.
So the Harvard gender experiment was so fascinating to read about. Remind us of the problem they were trying to solve. Was it that women would come into this elite graduate school with grades as good as the men's, but then wouldn't do as well once they got there?
Yes. For years and years, Harvard Business School, which the brand of Harvard Business School's success and the promise of the school is, them knowing how to fix organizations. For years and years, they had a real problem of their own, which is that the organization was really tough for women. Even Wall Street women, women who had been traders, would go through HBS and say, wow, I've never been to a place that is this difficult for women. Not everybody felt that way by any measure, but things were bad enough that the administrators and the professors were really very alarmed. It ranged from pretty much open sexual harassment in the classroom when professors were gone to a grade gap. Women were coming in with the same grades and scores as men, but then not doing as well at the school, to a real lack of female faculty. The numbers are very, very low, and there were even times, there was one year when a third of the female junior faculty left the school at once.
And this experiment, as you describe it, was massive, including training for the women students on things as mundane as how to raise your hand in class, for the men as well, for faculty members, as well as recruiting more women for the faculty. It even touched on their social lives. Give us the scope of how they set out to do this.
You know, that is why I really wanted to write the story, because I think many of us look at our own organizations and we say, and I'm not speaking about the New York Times here, just about the experience of being a professional woman in the workplace, we look at our organizations and we say, wow, you know, I wish my organization would get really, really serious about attacking the inequities that I see in my own organization. HBS is that organization. It is the rare organization that said, we're not going to do a study, we're not going to do a committee, we're going to do the whole thing. We're going to look at the entirety of women's experiences here. I'm going to give you two highlights. One is the classroom. So in the HBS classroom, 50% of your grade is class participation. And the classroom experience there is very intense. There are equations flying. There are jokes flying. The professor is cold calling students. And in that environment, women tended to hang back. So the school did everything from boosting hand-raising coaching for students. These very accomplished students would get to HBS, men and women in their mid-20s, and they would be retaught how to raise their hand.
Bizarre.
So that women would really assert themselves. And also, the administration introduced a kind of new widget in the grading software so that professors could instantly see their calling and marking patterns by gender, because there was a big suspicion that women were not being heard, that even women who did speak up were not being taken as seriously as the men. Now, on the other end of things, the administrators really did feel that the school's social life was a problem. Like a lot of business schools, Harvard Business School's social life, not all of its social life, but there is a kind of debauched element to it, and there always has been, a lot of really heavy drinking. The amount of disposable income that is sloshing around that campus, especially now in the era of the 1% of the 1%, mm-hmm. is really, really high, and they wanted to kind of bring it back down to earth. They also felt, and this was a sort of uncomfortable observation, that they had really seen over the years that single women were not doing as well as married women, and it was because, you know, and I spoke to many people who said this themselves, that if you're a single woman at HPS and you want to do academically, but let's be honest, you're also 27 years old, you're looking for a mate, you could feel like you have to choose between academic and social success. In that classroom environment, it can be difficult to be both the aggressive, ambitious one and the kind of appealing, dateable one at the same time. And women felt they had to make that choice.
So listeners, anyone out there from the Harvard B School class of 2013 or anyone else from other schools or earlier classes or in the business world in general who can relate here, male or female, call in and react. Maybe you read Jody Cantor's story in the New York Times about the Harvard Business School, or maybe you're just hearing this described for the first time, and we'll get into how this experiment has worked out so far. But call in and react or tell us your story at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And spoiler alert, you're right that at the end of the class's 2 years, success. The women were scoring as high as the men in their coursework. So it worked?
I'll give you sort of my assessment from all of my reporting on what worked and what didn't work from this experiment. What people say pretty much uniformly at the school is that the student experience is much, much better. My editor and I talked a lot during the story process about how the main character of the story was kind of the character of HBS itself. And what you're watching it do in sort of a painful way sometimes in the course of this story is go from a place that is really tough for women to a place that is much, much better for women. If you talk, it's funny, some of the students from HBS who have reacted to the story, you know, have said, wait a second, you know, I got here 2 or 3 weeks ago, and this seems like an amazing place for women. I don't understand your story. So that, in a way, is a testament to the success of the administrators, that women arriving on campus feel that way. Mm-hmm. However, there is another side of the story, and this is an area where Harvard admits that they've made very little progress, and that is the faculty problem. There are just very few women who teach at business school. You know, a quarter of the tenured faculty is female. There are some female star professors, but women have really, really struggled. It's not clear what HBS can really do to solve the problem. They would have to get incredibly aggressive to boost their numbers of female faculty. And by the way, this comes from women students. Women students believe this is a real problem. They say they need to see more women at the front of the classroom.
Are they not out there in the pool because there aren't women in equal numbers to men in the high ranks of the business world?
Well, you know, if you're a 25-year-old woman interested in business and you're really good with numbers, you're really good with complicated business concepts, are you going to go into the business world or are you going to pursue a somewhat solitary and risky academic path where you could work for 10 years at Harvard to get tenure, and you could still very, very, very easily be turned down. Mm. It is really hard to attract women to that pipeline.
This is WNYC FM, HD, and AM, New York Public Radio, and New Jersey Public Radio, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcom, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. As Jody Cantor is still with us, New York Times correspondent who wrote about this massive gender experiment at Harvard in the business school. Before we get to some of our many calls, you wrote, well, actually, you know what? We have somebody who is a 2013, law school grad, but all right, we'll take him anyway and go to our first caller right now. Alex on the Lower East Side, you're on WNYC. You're a 2013 grad of Harvard Law, is that right?
That's right, Brian.
So congratulations, first of all.
Thanks. Well, there's a big student movement called Shattered the Ceiling at Harvard Law School that's been trying to raise awareness about these issues. But unfortunately, we haven't seen the sort of systemic changes or buy-in that you hear about from the business school. And that's kind of disappointing, especially when you see the same sort of gender gap with law review, honors, and those sorts of things.
What would it take?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think that the law school community is increasingly realizing that we have to overhaul legal education generally. I think as a component of that, we have to redo the, you know, the classroom experience. There are major issues with the Socratic method and how it's applied and how what sort of traits are rewarded. But beyond that, I think that, you know, having more women faculty, I mean, honestly, I'm not smart enough to
right.
come up with this.
But you're acknowledging that this exists at the law school, too.
Yeah, and I'm so glad Alex called in because this is a whole twist on the story that I don't think anyone anticipated. Harvard Law School is the home of Elizabeth Warren. It's the home of Elena Kagan. For a long time, it had a reputation as a pretty good place for women. And yet, as Alex said, in the past couple of years, students have really been driving this issue and saying, we think we're, you know, we think this is fundamentally unfair. We're not okay with the way things are. The numbers of women on Law Review are incredibly striking. And I think what Alex said is really the most interesting twist, which is that people are beginning to question whether the Socratic method itself is sexist. And that's a controversial question because there are women at Harvard Law School who come back and say, hey, the Socratic method is the best training there is for speaking up in a courtroom. And if you're not willing to be questioned and to answer questions in a semi-public setting, you shouldn't be a lawyer. So that is a very rich debate, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it plays out.
Maybe that's your next article. Anne in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Anne.
Hi. I did not go to HBS. I was in a technical PhD program at Stanford in the 80s, and then I subsequently went to law school at a top 10 school. And I found the article fascinating because it was a more extreme version of what I experienced back then. There was not so much in my PhD program, but definitely at Harvard, Stanford Business School, where we had a great deal of overlap in faculty and students. It was a highly, highly sexualized and harassing culture. To the point where every Friday the MBA students would have a party. They called it a liquidity preference function. And the goal was there was a lottery that went on all during the party, and at the end of the party, two winners would go off for a weekend someplace paid for by the business school. And the winners could bring a guest. So the idea was that people would sort of, as they got eliminated, would try to lobby the people who remained in case the ones who remained were winners. This was considered completely acceptable. You know, people would behave in this way, you know, young people, and yes, it was a sexualized environment, but it was insane to me that this was accepted by the administration.
Do you think it's something the administration could actually influence? Because part of the backlash that we haven't talked about yet that Jody reported in her piece is that people thought, well, okay, you know, control what we do in class, but don't establish rules over us grown-ups in terms of what we do in the bars at night.
You know, I think that's a good point, but the problem is that it was just an extension of what was going on in the classroom. The women, I've experienced this repeatedly. I would ask a question that I had actually formed before opening my mouth, and I would get interrupted, and the professor would answer a different question, whereas the men would ask some they make a series of rambling statements interrupting themselves and never be interrupted by the faculty member. And I think that there was just a huge disrespect and sort of negation of the women in the room.
And thank you very much. And, you know, Jody Cantor, no surprise to you, we have a board full of women, and we could take call after call after call saying, yeah, me too at this school, yeah, me too at that school.
Absolutely. We opened up a comment function on the story, and the war stories that came from New York Times readers were really remarkable and very sad. I mean, people told different versions of what you just heard again and again and again. And so part of what our aim was in publishing this story is that a lot of these conversations go on at individual schools, right? There is reckoning. There are men who totally know this is a problem and want to address it. There are female faculty members who are really upset about it. Those conversations tend to take place within the school, and I do think it's fascinating to talk in a broader way about these themes and issues, such as the issue you just raised, which is how far can any school school administration go to really control what happens at 11:30 at night on a campus, especially, by the way, among grad students who are not 17 or 18 years old. They're in their mid-20s.
You did write about some sarcastic T-shirts that some students began to wear in protest of the gender equality push. How big a backlash was there?
There was a backlash on campus at the end of the first year. There were definitely students who supported what the deans were doing, but even students who supported them had some execution issues. The Harvard Business School Administration was so serious about taking care of this problem that they really, in some cases, did make the students feel, you know, the quote in the story is that, like, we're back in kindergarten or first grade. They did things like organizing. Students had always organized their own study groups for class, and instead the deans decided who could be in which study group or whether they could wear Halloween costumes to class or not. Also, even though these students are all over the drinking age, there's a lot of control at Harvard over when you can drink where, and they punished one student who actually hadn't been drinking himself, but they held responsible for other people's drinking, and that did provoke a lot of resentment. But, you know, in kind of a rich thematic way, because you look at that series of episodes and there's a student who's quoted in the story saying, how far can HBS go? Do we have school uniforms here? And I think that is a perfectly fair question.
Jagruti in Summit, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how are you? I'm very interested to read Jody's article, and I've been involved in the W50 conference at Harvard, a class of 88. I'm going back for my 25th reunion this year, and this conversation's been going on for a while. And I just want to say a couple of things. One, it is an experiment that Dean Noria is executing. I think some aspects of it are going to work, some aspects of it are not, and the administration is going to have to learn from it and you know, adjust and make changes accordingly. And I, too, had some of the reactions that Jody mentioned about going too far on the social scene perspective. However, I do think that, you know, Harvard is in this situation where it does need to help women in two ways. One is in the context that the women are dealing with today, out in the business world as well as obviously at the business school. And second, I think help structurally, make cultural changes and do it in a way that engages both men and women in a conversation so that, in fact, the business world out there reflects the society, not just what women want, not just what the men want, but it is something that needs to be developed, and it's just not out there today.
But about the business world out there, one of the other quotes in Jody's article was from somebody who wondered if Harvard can actually prepare their women business school students for the outside world by creating such an extremely affirmative environment at the school when the real world is not like that. So are they preparing them to go out into the, you know, the macho, hard-drinking, male-dominated, high-level business world as it actually exists, or are they unpreparing them by making Harvard so cushy for them relatively?
There was a professor who told me a great story about that. She said that a couple of years ago, when things were further behind on women's issues at the school, there were men who used to say to her, who used to comment on her body, you know, nice butt kind of stuff. And she said that whenever that happened, she made a real point of handling it well in front of the female students because she wanted to show them how to be tough and how to deal with something like that, and that you need to be completely unflappable. She said that a small part of her regrets that never happens anymore because she feels like she's lost a teachable moment and an opportunity to show them how to handle that.
Interesting. Jagruti, anything you want to add about that?
No, I think that it's a fine dance between the current context and kind of developing a better future. And I do think Harvard has an extremely important role to play in handling today's context as well.
Thank you very much. We have a few more minutes with Jody Cantor, New York Times correspondent, who wrote that massive article and a follow-up about gender and then class at the Harvard Business School and this big gender equality experiment they're doing there. We're going to touch on class. We're going to touch on her other article this week on the Christine Quinn campaign and gender. But I want to get one more call in here, and I think for a very good reason. Gary in South Orange at the Rutgers Business School. Gary, you go to the Rutgers Business School presently?
Yeah, I currently go there, and I'm majoring in supply chain management.
And?
And I mean, I see a lot of great people in the class and everything, but it's a really diverse school and it's a great school. But the majority of the people that I see called on, the majority of people I see speaking, are generally the men in the class.
So it's not just that they elite colleges like Harvard.
Right. I mean, I think people are people everywhere. But at the same time, the times when I see people, men and women, really speaking up is in moral and social issues. Like when we talk about climate change, we talk about banning on fracking. And there's even a great organization called 350.org where I see a lot of women becoming interested in. And that's where we divest.
Yeah, that's it. Anti-climate change organization. So do you think that lessons should be learned from what you're hearing about happened at Harvard at a place like Rutgers?
Well, I see that there are avenues where women seem to be more outspoken and if you're passionate about what you're doing and if you feel like if you're seeing moral issues or social issues or even climate change issues that really affects you emotionally, then maybe try and gravitate toward that and don't try and stick yourself in a hole that doesn't really fit for you.
But what if you just want to be, the richest person in supply chain management?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are great avenues for supply chain in terms of something that might strike true to your heart. Like for me personally, I really find trying to make the world as green as possible very emotional for me, and I want to try and navigate that through supply chain.
All right.
So if you're a woman with that, if you're a woman and you find something that you associate something with emotionally, then why not try and connect with what you're learning, what you're doing, and trying to be rich in doing it, and with supply chain, trying to convert as many businesses as you can to greener practices.
Yeah, good. And Gary, I got to go, but interesting call, and good luck out there with that. I hope you do really well and can combine doing well in business with that social goal that you obviously have. So, Jody Cantor, you did a follow-up article 2 days later about class divides in the Harvard Business School, and it looked like you got some reader response that said, for all the hype about gender issues at the school, class is actually a much bigger problem. Is that why you wrote the follow-up?
Well, people were saying that in our original article. In my original reporting, there was this really fascinating episode where the deans had organized this discussion that was supposed to be about gender and sexual harassment, and instead it took off in this totally different direction with students really saying that they felt oppressed by the money culture at the school. I should say Harvard Business School has an extraordinary number of really wealthy students, and there are regular wealthy students, and then there are the really wealthy students who live a totally different lifestyle. I mean, just to give you an example, there was one student who lived in a penthouse apartment at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel instead of in the dorms. So this is, the 1% of the 1% of the 1%. And it's created some conflict on campus. So we had that in the original story. But then when the story was published, people really focused on that scene. And also particularly on, it turns out there's a kind of secret society at Harvard Business School called Section X, and they go on these extremely elaborate vacations. They throw these very splashy parties, and they cause an enormous amount of resentment among students.
It's not the same secret society that George Bush and John Kerry were both in?
No, that was an undergraduate one. And so and this one is really based on how much money you have. And so so the reader reaction, especially from recent graduates of the school, was like, we heard from a lot of women who said, look, by the time I was there, the gender stuff had really gotten a lot better, but man, let me tell you about the class issues. And so we did do a follow-up about that, and there are two issues. One is that there is this idea at business school that you go there to create your network, and so there's a lot of pressure to spend money so that you can do fun things that will let you bond with people. So we talked to students who were borrowing tens of thousands of dollars a year, not just for tuition, not for room and board, but to keep up socially so they could go on these ski weeks and vacations and to these fancy parties that cost a lot of money, and students have really had kind of enough of that. The second issue is the way that the super wealthy students on campus kind of segregate themselves into the secret society and go and do activities that other people can't afford. And it is kind of a questionable concept because you say to yourself, Harvard Business School is such an elite place, and yet even within this elite environment, the ultra, ultra, ultra wealthy are creating this little world of their own.
And interesting to me from your article was that in the 70s, it was considered kind of gauche to really show off how much money you had and display it. And America has changed to the point where they just go ahead and flaunt it today. But do they have a stomach at Harvard for following up the gender experiment with a class experiment?
That is the fascinating question and the right question. I think it's really hard. I think money is really personal. It's hard to talk about. The school, you know, this is a school created for people who want to learn how to make a lot of money, right? So it's endemic to the identity of the school. In the article, I included a really provocative proposal from the business writer, Tom Peters, and he said, here's what HBS needs to do. If an ultra, ultra wealthy kid applies to this school, they need to prove that they've done something of social value to get in. You know, if you're 27 years old and your family is worth, you know, $1 billion, it's not too much to ask that you have, you know, given something back to society by age 27. So I have no idea whether HBS would ever be willing to accept something like that, but stay tuned.
Before you go, briefly on your Christine Quinn article. Who thinks gender was an issue here? She lost every major demographic group, including women and gays, to de Blasio and ran a Stay the Course campaign when the Democratic Party electorate wanted a change candidate. So in light of all that, how much room was there for any gender bias to have played a role?
Nobody thinks she lost because of gender. She doesn't seem to think so. Her campaign aides don't think so. The exit polls don't say so. We didn't think so as reporters who reported the story. However, what we did find in our reporting is that she really did face a lot of gender-related trouble. And so I don't think the question is, did Christine Quinn lose because of gender? I think the question is, we fashion ourselves this sort of progressive feminist city that's okay with powerful women. So how come when a woman runs for mayor, does she face the kind of gratuitous, visceral nastiness that Christine Quinn did?
What jumped out at me was not the obvious John Catsimatidis quote and, you know, who's surprised that John Catsimatidis said something like, if I have to listen to Christine's voice for the next 4 years, I'm going to die. The worst bias you reported on, it seemed to me, came from females who were supporters of Quinn, who carped about her wardrobe, her hair, and her voice.
That's right. And then the other thing that came out that I think was fascinating was Quinn's own deeply mixed attitude about this. We chronicled this meeting that a bunch of really high-powered New York women had with her in July, where they basically said to her, look, you need, I mean, they almost said, I don't think they said this in the meeting, but what they almost said was like, you need to read Lean In. You need to understand that any woman pursuing power is going to face a serious set of likability issues and other issues. And she did not really engage. She said, I want to be admired for my ideas, and I don't want gender to play a role in my race. Meanwhile, by the end of the race, she was basically saying, vote for me because I'm a woman. But I think that gets to a really important sort of post-lean-in debate we're having, which is, you know, to what extent, if you're a woman who seeks some sort of power, do you listen to the social science and do you sort of follow these rules of what you're supposed to do and what you're supposed to say? Or do you say, if we're ever going to get anywhere, we have to stop tiptoeing, around? I can't make myself completely unthreatening, and I just have to go ahead and run. It, Quinn did the latter, and it seems not to have served her particularly well in this race.
And we just have 30 seconds left, and then we're going to talk about the shockingly large number of uncounted votes in that mayoral primary that we only have learned about in the last day. But do you see the bias issues you wrote about at the Harvard Business School and those surrounding the Quinn campaign as related in 30 seconds?
That's a great question. I think that what both have in common is that Harvard Business School in the past and the New York City electoral environment right now, they're atmospheres of intimidation for women, you know, where it requires extraordinary commitment to, you know, as a woman, sort of force yourself through them, and you're going to face a lot of stuff that guys don't face. And again, I would put that in the past mostly for Harvard Business School, but still, as we see with Quinn, certainly the present for New York. And so that's what I think they have in common.
Jody Kantor, New York Times correspondent, wrote the article about the Harvard Business School and gender, the Harvard Business School and class, and Christine Quinn and gender and sexuality, all in the Times this week. And she's the author of the book about Barack and Michelle Obama called The Obamas. Jody, thank you so much for giving us so much time today.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And yes, coming up next, the new revelations that many more thousands of votes from Tuesday's Democratic mayoral primary seem to remain uncounted than we thought there were. Stay tuned.